So the story is told about a gentleman who got a new job as the university professor. So he moves into the city, and they get him a beautiful home. And he comes with his family, and he moves into the home, and he comes inside, and it's a gorgeous, beautiful house. There's only one problem. As soon as he comes in, he starts moving his stuff in. He notices that there's no water in the house. Nothing here. He turns on the faucet, nothing works. Goes to the shower, nothing works. So he's new in town. He opens up the Yellow Pages, looks for a plumber, finds a plumber. The plumber comes over to the house. So what seems to be the problem? He said, there's no water in the house. He says, I'll fix that for you, no problem. Plumber goes around. A few minutes later, he comes back, said, Doc, all done. Perfect. He said, that's amazing. Goes over to the faucet, it works beautifully. He said, that's terrific. He says, tell me, what do I owe you? He says, $250. He said, $250? You should excuse me, he said. You were here about 6 minutes. $250? I tell you the truth, he said. I'm the president of the university. I don't make $250 in 6 minutes. And the plumber said, of course, he said. When I was the president of the university, I didn't make $250 in 6 minutes either. Takes time to sink in a little bit. Yeah. I'll wait. Yeah. I should have told that joke on Shabbos because these jokes don't work. There's the ones you use on Shabbos. The ones you don't. Anyway. Anybody, is there a point to the joke? I was afraid someone would ask me that. The point of the joke is, of course, is quite obvious. I'll let you figure it out. You have to make decisions wisely, folks. People are in very lucrative positions and they get great salaries, but sometimes they give up what's most important. In this case, the university professor became a plumber. Now, there's nothing wrong with plumbers, don't get me wrong, I want to be politically correct. But if you're suited well to be a university professor, even if you're not making what the plumber makes, that's what you should be doing. And all the decisions we make, and a lot of people make decisions about how to spend their time, and indeed spend valuable time. I know people in this audience, some of whom I've met today, many of whom I've met today, who spend really significant time and take serious financial loss because they're spending hours, many, 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 many hours a week just trying to be Makarev Achenu B'nai Yisrael. It's really amazing. You talk about Mesiras Nefesh, you're talking about really giving up your time, and for some people, giving up some very serious financial reward just for this tremendous mitzvah. You have to make your decisions wisely. How are you going to spend your time? Over this past Shabbos, I think we all agreed, at least me walking around, that if you missed it, if you were not here Shabbos, you missed something very, very, very special. How many of you agree with that? You plan and you plan. It's like a bar mitzvah, you know. You plan, you plan, you plan, and then it really happens. It's unbelievable. And it was, we had such siyata d'shmaya. Everybody, you know, running from one place to another. It was just fantastic. Something extremely, extremely special. And of course, a big part of that special Shabbos that we had is the gentleman that you're about to hear from again, who I'm sitting next to. And I can't possibly say the same introduction again that I said today, although I could if you really want me to, just say the exact same thing. But I want to tell you what it's like, at least for me, over the last years, just listening to Rabbi Pesach Krohn. There was a great attorney in the United States. Some of the older folks in the audience might remember the name Louis Neiser. Remember Louis Neiser? Of course. Louis Neiser was really one of the great litigators. One of the great... You walked into a courtroom and you saw Louis Neiser sitting at the bench. You were afraid. You knew that this guy was probably going to win the case. He knew that there was one moment during any trial that was the most crucial moment. And that was when his opponent, his adversary, the other attorney, the prosecuting attorney, whoever it may be, would get up and speak to the jury and sum up the entire case. Because at that time, that summation to the jury would be extremely powerful. Now, how's he going to do anything in order to prevent this adversary from making his points to the jury? And Louis Neisser figured it out. And here's what he did. At that time, smoking was permitted in all buildings, even in courtrooms. You could smoke. Wherever you went, people smoked. He smoked a cigar, Louis Neisser. And listen to this genius. What he decided to do is he took his cigar whenever he went into an important case, and whoever's that last day before the summation of the trial, and he took a very thin wire and he placed it right down the center of the cigar, and it was protruding past the end of the cigar several inches. Then he started smoking, and the ashes started to come out at the end of the cigar, but they just wouldn't fall. The ashes don't go anywhere. So while the attorney's up there talking to the jury's just watching that cigar. And they're wondering, when are the ashes? They're not listening to him. They just, how's that happening? Genius, genius. That's what it's like for me listening to Rabbi Pesach Brown. You simply cannot get distracted. You just can't. No matter what else is going on in the room, I find anyway, I am transfixed. And it was such an honor to have him here today and speak so many, several times. And whenever we ask him, speak another session, more and more and more. So we ask him tonight again, of course, on Maaseh Shabbos, to again be Mahana the Olam. So please, it's a great kavod to introduce our wonderful friend and leader, Rabbi Pesach Brown.
That was close, but no cigar. It's a special schus to have spent this great, great Shabbos here. I cannot thank enough Rabbi Matt Trapp, my dear friend Rabbi Yaakov Solomon, and Rabbi Chaim Samson for inviting me to come to spend this great, great Shabbos, this first convention of Inspire that Mitzvah Shem will become an annual event. There's a very interesting Gemara in Psochim, Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. And the Gemara tells us, Shloisha minoichle ha'olam haba. There are three that are guaranteed to have olam haba. And the Gemara mentions two of them, and the third one is, Hamavdil al hayayin b'moitzoi Shabbos, the one who makes havdalah on wine on Motzei Shabbos. And the Gemara says, Mahi, what do you mean? Why is that? And the Gemara explains that in the time of the Gemara, there were many people that did not have enough wine. Today, wine is obviously available to everyone. But wine was a rare commodity in the time of Chazal. And if somebody would make Kiddush on Friday night, and everybody likes to drink wine, so a person would finish all the wine Friday night for Kiddush, and then he wouldn't have to make wine for Havdalah. But the Gemara says that somebody that can control themselves, because we know that when you make a bracha on wine, it's very chashev, and the Meshayer Mekedusha LeAvdalta, he leaves over from Kiddush to Havdalah, he's able to control himself, and then he's able to make that bracha on wine, Motzei Shabbos, such a person is Zoicha to Olam Haba. Listen to the expression, and I think that there's a very deep meaning to this Gemara. The Meshayer Mekedusha LeAvdalta. He left over from the Kiddush to Havdalah. I think that that describes our role for the rest of our lives. We have to take from the Kiddush, from the Helikite of this Shabbos, the Meshayer Mekedusha. We have to take and leave over from the Kiddush, from the holiness, from the inspiration of Shabbos, La'avdalta, to the days of the week for the rest of our lives. We came to an unusual convention. The scope of the convention was to inspire not only ourselves, but to make sure that we inspire others. On this Shabbos we've come, the Meshayer Mekedusha Lavdalta, to bring from that holiness, to bring sanctity to the secular days of the week. I want to share with you a beautiful story. A story that was told to me first by a girl in a Gateshead seminary. I was in Gateshead in England, and a girl comes over to me, and the story seemed so unusual and so remarkable that, of course, I had to hear it from the person himself to whom it happened. And she told me that it happened to her father. Her father, before he became Frum, was known as Sam Zeitlin. Sam Zeitlin was a phenomenal cyclist. He would win one bicycle race after the other. As a matter of fact, in 1966, he won what was known as the New York State Sprint Championship. And Sam Zeitlin told me that there was tremendous jealousy on that team, that New York team, because people couldn't stand that he was Jewish. And one day he told me he was riding in Queens on Casino Boulevard, near Casino Park, where they had a track. And as he was driving home, he was on his bike and he was riding home, all of a sudden the car zoomed up behind him and he thought that the car would run him over. He ran onto the sidewalk with his bike behind the tree. So if the car would crash, it would crash into the tree, and the car skidded to a stop. And two guys yelled out, "You dirty Jew, we won't let you be the winner of any other races." They were two of his teammates. They couldn't stand him. He told me that the anti-Semitism was so bad that in 1967 there was what was known as the Grand Prix in Northbrook, Illinois, a cycling race. And he told me he was ahead by 3 seconds. He knew for sure he was going to win the race. Anybody who followed the Olympics knows that 1/10 of a second can win a race in glory for someone. He was 3 seconds ahead of everyone. As he came to the finish line, he lifted his hands in victory. And he was disqualified. They imposed a rule that they never imposed before or afterwards. The rule in cycling is that as you go over the finish line, at least one hand has to be on the handlebar, because otherwise you're jeopardizing the spectators that are around there. So therefore, being that both his hands were off the bike, so therefore he was disqualified. And then he decided that's the end. It's obvious that they hate Jews. In the cycling world, he's going to go someplace. Canada was too cold. Mexico was too high. He decided, I'll go to Israel. The Maccabeans had a team, and he decided he's going to join the Maccabean team. He won a championship in Eretz Israel, and then it came time to practice for the Olympics. While he was in Eretz Israel, of course, he's a Jewish boy. He's not religious. He goes to the Kaisel one night, and he's trying to daven whatever he knows. He had very minimal background, but there were two brothers who saw him, David Goldberg and Chaim Goldberg. David Goldberg today is a Rosh Hashiva and tells his father-in-law, Rabbi Isaac Osband, who should have a Refuah Shleima. And David Goldberg and Chaim Goldberg started talking to this fellow, and they saw that he had an interest in Yiddishkeit, and they sent him to a fellow, Gershon Weinberger. And Gershon Weinberger, who was into Kiruv before anybody else was into Kiruv, he saw this is a Keli, this is somebody who's really interested. And so he invited him for Shabbos. And the boy, Sam Zeitlin, became Shimon Pesach Zeitlin. And he started becoming Frum. And you would not believe it. Long before Eish HaTorah started, Rav Noach Weinberg started a yeshiva. The yeshiva was not called Eish HaTorah in those days. It was called Mogen Avraham. Sam Zeitlin was the fifth Talmud of Rav Noach Weinberg. Of course, now he's in the yeshiva, and he has to try out for the team that's going to put a cycling team into the Olympics. And the tryouts are on Shabbos. So he goes to Rav Noach Weinberg, and he says, "What should I do? I want to try out for the Olympics." Rav Noach said, "You should try out for the Olympics. It would be a tremendous Kiddush Hashem that a yeshiva man in Mogen Avraham, which eventually became Eish HaTorah, would be known all over the world as the greatest cyclist of all." And Sam Zeitlin told me himself that when he used to pedal to that song that Gershon Weinberger taught him, Shabbos Hayoyim Lashem. I don't know exactly how the song goes, but that song was the cadence to which he would cycle. But then he said to Rav Noach, but the tryouts are on Shabbos. He said, go to the coach, tell him, how can he do this in Israel on Shabbos? And he went to the coach, and the coach said, we are not a bunch of rabbis, we're a bunch of cyclists. And if you don't like it, you'll be off the team. He said, this is Israel. How could you do this in Israel? He said, go on at Geholfen. What happened was that they had the tryouts on Shabbos. Of course, he wouldn't go. And that year, Israel could not send a cycling team to the Munich Olympics in 1972. In 1972, by your reaction, I see that you know as well as I do that two Israeli athletes were killed right away. The Palestinians kidnapped another nine, and it will be debated till the end of time whether the Germans should have gotten into a gunfight with them, but those nine other hostages were killed on the spot even before the gunfight developed. And Shimon Pesach Zeitlin heard in Eretz Yisrael over the news